Welcome to Still Dreaming, an existential wandering through our forever night. Forever Night was episodic, but this podcast kind of isn't. You may be best served starting at the beginning with the introduction and working your way forward. So with that, let's begin. Welcome back, gentle listener, to Still Dreaming, your place for all your endless sleepless nights. Tonight we consider the episode of Forever Night entitled Dance by the Light of the Moon. It was directed by Michael Levine and written by Roy Sallows, and it originally aired on May 26, 1992. So I'm going to tell you straight out, folks, this episode sucks. It's not well written, the main guest star is not good, and the plot doesn't make much sense. It sucks. The theme of the episode, so far as I can detangle it from all of the cringeworthy dialogue, has something to do with power and exerting control over others. So for that reason, the theory we'll be addressing tonight comes mostly from Nietzsche and his concept of the will to power. Now, Nietzsche may not be an existentialist proper, but he's a major influence, and his works are usually grouped in with existentialism as an important precursor, just as Kierkegaard was. I'll also be mentioning some Arthur Schopenhauer a bit, who was important to Nietzsche's writing. And I must say I am heavily indebted to the book The Affirmation of Life, Nietzsche on Overcoming Nihilism, by Bernard Regenster for a clarification on Nietzsche's details. Really important source for this episode. So let's just get into it. The synopsis tells us this. Investigating the murder of an accountant and a respected cop, Nick's case leads him to a bewitching stripper, obsessed with death fantasies, causing him to remember how Jeanette seduced him. So, the summary is a bit misleading. This isn't all that the episode is about, an exotic dancer with a death fetish. That on its own might have been interesting, but there's more to it, or maybe there is less to it. The show's kind of stupid. Let's just get started. The cold open. A man walks into a construction site at night. A seductive voice beckons him. He meets a woman there, and things start to become passionate. He's stolen something for her. There's definitely a sexual component, like he's under her control, her spell. But then suddenly, the man gets attacked with a garrote from behind. He's dead in like 3 seconds, like quickest strangling death ever. The new guy, it's made explicit, killed for the woman. There's no motivation, it seems, rather than just to please her. There's more sensual teasing. Then the woman suddenly pulls out a knife, and she stabs him dead right in the gut. He actually dies even faster. Especially impressive, given he was stabbed in the stomach. You'd think it'd take longer to bleed out. She takes the stolen goods, and she leaves. Okay. At this point, I'm thinking this woman either has supernatural powers of mind control, or there's some larger plot involving the Imizumi Syndicate, and these two dead rubes are just pawns in some double cross. That sends us to the opening credits. We're at the police station. One of the murdered men was a cop named Burkhart. Skanky's mad at the suggestion that Burkhart could be a killer, but Nick explains the evidence. Burkhart was the man who strangled the first guy, who was an accountant. Both men had lipstick from the same women on them. So it's going to look like a jealousy killing, I guess, but we the audience know there's something else going on. The chief comes in. He was close to Burkhart. He tells Nick to dig deep to figure out what happened. Chief can't seem to accept that Burkhart was crooked or be lured into something scandalous. Yeah, because that never happens. Okay, benefit of the doubt. The chief knew the guy really well, and anyone, I guess, would be shocked to find out a friend you thought was on the straight and narrow actually wasn't. And to be fair, the chief doesn't deny the evidence. He's just upset he was apparently duped. Flashback time. Nick sits at the head of a table. We're in some kind of medieval feast hall. Is this just after the Crusades, I guess? Even at a feast, he's brooding. He sees Jeanette. Is this for the first time? It's not clear. She calls out, I'll say seductively, to Nick, and it seems to work. Although I think if I just stood in the middle of a restaurant and called out, "How much do you want me?" breathlessly into the crowd, I'd get a distinctively different reaction. But then I'm not Deborah Duchenne, either. Back to the present. The chief is asking, what makes a good man evil? The eternal question, Nick says. This raises an interesting question for me. Was Nick ever a good man? We're sort of led to assume so, but so far the show has not given us any indication what kind of man Nick was before he was brought over. So let's pause for a moment to consider the often misunderstood idea of will to power. There are many interpretations of this concept, and the most famous writings about it are by Friedrich Nietzsche, who developed this idea out of and largely against the previous writings of Arthur Schopenhauer. Nietzsche wanted to counter Schopenhauer's stark pessimism and nihilism. Schopenhauer thought that any pleasure was actually a negative state. What we take as pleasure or satisfaction is only the absence of pain. Pain is our most common state. Our desires and longings are what we pursue to find momentary relief from suffering. But such relief is always only temporary. Nietzsche objects to this pessimism and modifies Schopenhauer's ideas about the will to live into his own formation of will to power. For Nietzsche, will to power is an essential human drive. It means that we require resistance and the overcoming of resistance and a perpetual, indefinite struggle in order to feel happiness and satisfaction. Will to power can only be satisfied while it engages in struggle. Once power is gained and resistance abets, the will becomes frustrated again. As Nietzsche writes in Beyond Good and Evil, quote, "In the end, one loves one's desire, and not what is desired." I'll try to come back to this later, but for now, let's return to the episode. We're in Natalie's lab. The victims have perfume and lipstick on them. The perfume is high-end, but pretty standard, but the lipstick is different. Not over-the-counter stuff. Theatrical is the word Natalie uses. Skanky finds out that both victims called the same number in the past few days, a strip club. And there's a little joke about Skanky calling women in the station honey. And Nick does the same to Nat in a scene that's cute and funny. The scene is also intended to establish what kind of relationship Nick and Nat have. It's friendly, flirty, comfortable, trusting. Nick's all in Nat's personal space, and she seems fine with that. And this will be relevant later. There's some nice shots of the caddy driving around the city in the full moon. They go to the strip club. In a nice touch, there's some kind of advertisement for an exhibition of medieval armor or something like that. I tried to pause the video to see, but it wasn't very clear. And Nick sort of does a double take as he goes past. It's just a nice touch. The strip club is called Jilly's, and there's pop rock music playing, green and blue neon lighting. A bunch of dudes sitting around watching young women dance and swing around on poles. It's TV safe, so everyone is fully clothed in tight spandex. I think the most we see is a midriff. Skanky acts like he's never seen women before, his jaw on the floor. Skanky, in this episode, isn't the calm, sharply dressed, competent-seeming detective he'd been in episode 4. He's schlubby again, slightly bumbling. I wonder if this episode was shot first, but I don't wonder hard enough to try to research it. Nick finds the manager. The manager is skeevy and smokes while wearing a black leather jacket, so you know he's skeevy. But he identifies pictures of the victims. The accountant was a regular, and the dead cop was somebody who'd come in a couple of times. Manager says the cop was investigating a fraud case and talked to some of the women. A new dancer takes the stage, and Nick is entranced. And it's fucking funny. This slow jam striptease with no actual stripping. It's 1990s primetime TV safe, not quite Cinemax level sexiness. And as it goes on, we start to hear a heartbeat sound. We flash back to medieval times and Jeanette, and then we hard cut back to the strip club. And at this point in the show, I am really thinking that this woman must have some kind of mind control power, either supernatural or through a chemical agent or something like that. And I don't think this is out of line, thinking that this could happen, because this is a show about vampires, and the very pilot of the show involved a plot about an ancient mystic Mayan ritual. So yeah, why not mind control? I just have a hard time thinking that Nick could be so easily and quickly seduced by a mortal woman in spandex twirling under neon lights when he's an 800-year-old vampire. These were my thoughts as we go to commercial break. When we come back, Nick is in the changing room with the stripper. She says she only talked to Burkhart, the cop, a couple of times. Nick slyly takes a sample of the lipstick under his fingernail while she's getting dressed. Kind of sneaky, I like it. She flirts with Nick. She comes on really strong. Nick seems interested, but maybe he's just playing along to keep her talking. They're interrupted by Donnie. Skanky found out the accountant was usually soft-spoken, but every once in a while, he would come in tipping big and throwing tons of cash around. And when asked about it, he would say it was okay, because it wasn't his. Dun-dun-dun. We're in a flashback again. Nicholas, brave knight. Jeanette speaks to him, whispering coyly. She offers to conquer him. Kinky. Surrender to the darkness of the night. And seriously, only Jeanette could say these lines without it being totally submerged in cheese. And even with sultry performance, it is borderline. We cut back and forth between Jeanette's seduction and the strip club, and Skanky's talking about how women like to play men. Nick comes back to reality and dismisses Skanky's casual misogyny. We all have our dark sides, says Nick. We cut to Nick's lair. An alarm goes off and he wakes up in bed. He opens the blinds and a few rays of the setting sun stream in. Skanky comes over, having worked all day, and says the accountant had been embezzling a lot of money from one of his clients. The money wasn't found, not in any known accounts. Nick gets called into station, and Skanky leaves to get some sleep. We arrive at Natalie's lab, and she's on a 1992 computer, and it's awesome. She found a match with a lipstick sample. She confronts Nick about the stripper. They've got a really flirty vibe this episode, which of course I love, but she doesn't like his interest in the stripper. Well, me neither, Nat. She's clearly hurt by Nick putting his attention on another woman. But she doesn't go all jealous rage or anything, and I actually like the response from Natalie. It seems appropriate. It seems right. Nick is broody, because of course he is, and he's distant. We might still be able to consider Nick's interest in the stripper, her name is Anne, as limited to the case, but that wouldn't explain his attitude towards Natalie. I would have liked it if he had offered some reassurance to Nat, even if it was seemed like he was lying. I don't know. In this scene, it seems like he's in a trance or something. I really wonder about the performance. Back at Jilly's in the alleyway, and Nick is following Anne, first on foot, then by car. She realizes she's being followed because the caddy sticks out like a sore thumb. He follows her to her apartment. Nick flies up into the air to get to her window. In the middle of the fucking city. He literally flies into her fucking window. Nobody sees this? This is just okay. He's standing there, all cocky and sure of himself when she walks into her own living room, and she is not surprised by his being there at all. Commercial break. So when we come back from commercial, she thinks he took the service elevator. Okay, so how did he get in the apartment before she did, when she knew she arrived at the building before he did, and how did he get into the door then? Huh? Thinking this through. To be clear, we are given no indication that Nick has done any mind trick on her. She's just kinda dumb. She reveals that she's actually a corporate lawyer, and that's how she can afford such a nice apartment. She left practicing law to be a dancer/stripper. Because she likes the power it gives her over men. What? Who the fuck wrote this? I mean, a man wrote this, right? But for fuck's sake, this is the stupidest plot ever. Now, I'm not saying exotic dancers and adult entertainers can't be satisfied with the work. That's not what I'm saying. The writers of this show definitely paints the pictures that these professions are lesser than and inherently immoral. That's pretty clear. Anne rejects her high-class and respectable job as a lawyer for what we, the audience, are supposed to understand as low-class and non-respectable. And since when do lawyers not exert power over people? This is the point in the episode where everything kind of falls apart. There's a flashback, and it gives us more sexy time with Jeanette. We intercut between Jeanette in the past and Anne in the present. Jeanette is seductive, whispering dark promises. Anne is flirty and leading. And we're supposed to equate the two as the audience. Jeanette lured Nick to the dark side, to vampirism, although we're not told yet exactly what her motivations are. Anne talks about power and control and the sexual thrill she gets from manipulating others, specifically men, to do evil deeds. She's a literal femme fatale. Anne brings up the murders, and in so doing, she reveals things that were not released to the press. Nick notes this and says she'll be convicted, but Anne is not impressed. She goes on and on about people's dark sides. She likes to watch people's descent into evil, and she just goes on and on and on while rubbing up on Nick and pawing him. And Nick responds as though he's being seduced. And I just don't buy it. One, I don't find Anne's seduction to be, well, you know, seductive. She's about as subtle as a frying pan to the side of the head. And while the scenes with Jeanette are pretty on the nose, too, at least we've seen Jeanette before, and we already have an inkling to her personality, her past, her connection to Nick. Anne is the villain of the week, and she comes off in dialogue and performance as entirely one note. At this point watching the episode, I'm still thinking there's a mind control element to Anne's shtick. I just don't believe that an 800-year-old vampire, who could conceivably have whatever woman he wanted, could hurt, kill, dominate, control, with a few words, with immortal indifference to the lives of others, who has probably done all of these things already, and maybe worse over the centuries, that he would just casually fall prey to this woman's weak-arm seduction. I just don't buy it unless there's some external force at play. So, I think, there's something in the lipstick. They made a big deal about the lipstick. Nat's gonna find out there's a chemical or something in it that mind controls people, right? Right? Well, Anne wants Nick to steal for her the dead cop's casebook. And I guess we're supposed to feel like Nick is being corrupted? He's a vampire. He kills and lies and cheats to survive and has been doing that for hundreds of years. Ugh. Only darkness can satisfy you, Jeanette's voice whispers from the past. Which could have some resonance if it was set up at all in the program. But we don't see Nick struggle with his morality. We see him struggle with his mortality. In his book, The Gay Science, Nietzsche writes, quote, "The wish to preserve oneself is the symptom of a condition of distress, of a limitation of the really fundamental instinct of life, which aims at the expansion of power, and wishing for that frequently risks and even sacrifices self-preservation." Anne makes it clear that her motivation is the power she feels when she exerts will over others. And I am reading this in a very literal way as will to power, because frankly, this episode is so terrible, I'm struggling to find anything else to analyze. In the same book, Nietzsche describes the sex drive as, quote, lust for possession, end quote. And I don't think he's the first, and he's definitely not the last person to suggest this about the human sex drive. Anne exerts her will as a femme fatale over certain men, usurping their own wills, shaking them out of their own codes of morality, getting them to commit crimes inclusive of murder for her whim. Why would these men do this? This is never adequately explained in the episode, spoilers, but I'll offer this. Arthur Schopenhauer wrote about human suffering and how pleasure is sought out by us because we wish a temporary respite from pain. Unlike Schopenhauer, Nietzsche suggests that humans actually crave suffering because that's the signal of resistance. And it's resistance that allows us to gain power. I'm going to suggest that the men Anne has victimized felt the internal struggle within themselves to overcome their own moral limitations, feeling maybe trapped in their jobs or in their lives. The show doesn't tell us this, by the way. I'm reaching here. Anne's invitation to immorality is seized upon by them in a way for them to feel their own struggle, to push back against the stability of their own lives, and maybe in hopes of leveraging some control over Anne herself. Again, I'm reaching. Anne, for her part, plays the part of a biblical Lilith tempting others into the fall. I'll have more to say about her potential motivations later. But for now, back at the station, Skanky is mad at Nick for spending so much time with Anne, who he thinks killed Burkhart. And Skanky is right, she did kill Burkhart. And even now in the scene, Nick is hedging and saying that she hadn't incriminated herself to him. Skanky gets mad and yells at Nick. Skanky mentions Burkhart's notebook, the thing that Anne wants Nick to steal. The chief mentions that he has the notebook at his house and gives Nick the key to his apartment so he can get the notebook, which is all very trusting and very convenient. Nick and Skanky get pushy with each other, like really aggro and really sudden. We cut to Nat's lab. There's spooky music and someone seems to be creeping up behind her. It's Nick. He's distant and cold towards her. I wonder if the creepy vibe was supposed to suggest that Nat could be in danger from Nick. Nat put together the current murders with some previously unsolved murders that seemed similar. And again, this seems like it should be detective work, not medical examiner work, but what do I know? Nick is being a jerk, and she gets really pissy with him. And all of this feels super sudden. Like, the last scene where Nat seemed hurt and confused, Now she's mad and still hurt, but obviously angry now. She clearly thinks of herself and Nick as in a relationship, and he seems willing to just toss that aside. So I get the anger, but it still seems really sudden. We come back to Anne's apartment, and she burns the notebook Nick brought her. She didn't care about the notebook, just the act of stealing. And they make out. She wants him to do worse. And unless they explain that she has hypnosis drugs in her lipstick, I'm just not buying that an 800-year-old vampire will steal and murder and piss off Natalie just for a little nookie. Back at the station, Nick makes nice with Donnie, who fills Nick in on info about Anne's previous work as a stripper with some other guys died. It's finally some detective work. It's being played as though Nick is setting Skanky up, but, I mean, does anyone actually believe that? Skanky and Nick go to another construction site to take Anne into custody, and if Skanky didn't know something was up, why would he agree to go to some weird abandoned construction site? Anyway, Anne is dressed up to appeal to Skanky. She's all over Donnie, and kissing him, and it's all a clear mimic of the cold open. Nick pops up and strangles Donnie. Oh no! He gets smoochy with Anne. She talks about how good it felt to kill the cop. Nick reveals a hidden microphone. Oh yay, he's not evil after all. He has her confession on tape. Another guy comes in. It's the manager from the strip club. She yells, and the manager shoots Nick. Nick seems to get shot pretty frequently, doesn't he? And there's no backup? When cops do undercover things, especially where another cop is going to have to pretend die, wouldn't they have all kinds of units in the area waiting to swarm if the place if things go sideways? Between this and the lack of lighting in the police station, I am really wondering about the city of Toronto's budgeting. So Anne and the manager run off. Skanky gets up and is fine because it was all a ruse, of course. There was a foot chase. Nick flies again. Skanky and the manager have a shootout. Nick confronts Anne. She backs up to the edge of the building, and she jumps off. And for some reason, Nick will fly to the top of tall buildings to confront people, but he won't use his flight or super speed to save this bitch from falling. She's on the ground, and she's alive? She's talking? Not a drop of blood in sight, even though she had to have fallen 4 or 5 stories. She croaks out some lines, and they're stupid, and she dies. The guy with a knife in his belly died faster than this, seriously. We're back at the station for wrap-up time. So, we're at the station. Nick left a present of a rose and a bottle of perfume for Nat in her lab to make up for him being such a dick. I would have preferred a scene with him apologizing, but then I guess the writers would have to try to explain their stupid plot. To clarify, there was no mind control, just Anne's, what, animal magnetism? To answer the chief's question from the beginning, what makes a good man evil? Apparently just tits and ass. That's it. The moral of this episode is that men are stupid horn dogs who will literally kill for the thrill of being grinded on by a stripper. I'm going to have to remember that next time I want to refinance my student loans. We end with a flashback. Lacroix enters the room with Jeanette and Nick. Jeanette introduces him, and Lacroix says a really stupid line about being Nick's friend forever, and the show is over, and thank God, because this episode sucked. Ugh. If I haven't made it clear, this episode was stupid. Every little bit of it was stupid. Maybe, just maybe, Anne's whole seduction shtick might have been more plausible if it was Skanky instead. We've seen Skanky try to pick up women at the Raven. We've seen him talk up his sexuality. We've seen that he has arguments with his wife. He would have been more of the type, I think, to fall into Anne's trap than Nick. Then it would have been Skanky pushing away Nick, and Nick having to try to find a way to reach out to his friend and partner, to be the offer of salvation to Skanky. Now think about that as a narrative twist. The vampire serving as a moral anchor, pulling Skanky back from the darkness. It would have given Skanky some character development, and we could have seen a parallel of Nick choosing darkness. I mean, that could have been interesting, at least. And the flashbacks really don't give us much about Nick's motivations for becoming a vampire. Was it only Jeanette's seduction? Did he choose to be a creature of the night because Deborah Duchenne is hot? I mean, fair point and all, but really? That's it? The conceptual failing in the dialogue of this episode, as I see it, is the writer's conflation of power and sexuality. Those two things intersect, to be sure, but they're not synonymous. Anne kept talking about power, but her expression of power was entirely sexual. It doesn't help that the episode only showed us her kissing and kind of touching men, not in bed with them, making even the appeal to sex rather weak. And while I could accept that a sexual affair is implied with the accountant and Burkhart, it wasn't with Nick. If the episode had strung out the timing more, made us see her working her charms, I guess I'll call it, over a longer period of time, really getting her claws into Nick, or, as I mentioned, better yet, Skanky, then maybe it becomes more plausible. Anne, and maybe the men she targeted, might be understandable through some ideas Schopenhauer wrote about in his World as Will and Representation. For Schopenhauer, boredom is a feeling of frustration. It is, quote, longing without a determinate object, end quote. Anne tells us she had everything, a high-powered job with lots of money and respect, but she preferred her life as a dancer because it allowed her to explore her dark side and to tempt men into the same. She felt the pressure of her will to strive, but nothing to strive against. In her position as a dancer, socially below the men she targeted, she encounters resistance. She, quote, pulls them down, unquote, by seducing them to push against her own sense of identity, right and wrong. She finds satisfaction in being an agent of corruption. While her boredom might have led her to her wicked ways, her will to power had determinate ends, the downfall and destruction of her marks. But since will to power can only exist in the struggle, as soon as the men she targeted were disposed of, she needed new victims to feel so engaged. Power for Nietzsche is an activity, not a status. Just as with Anne, the fruits of her quest were not important. She didn't care about the men, what the men stole for her. Nietzsche's concept of will to power doesn't seek achievements, rather the process of achieving. Anne was cruel, psychopathic even. Cruelty and domination can be considered consequences of the will to power. Anne felt power over the men as she orchestrated their downfall and deaths. She obviously felt perverse pleasure in letting the men think she was beneath them socially, herself knowing her own previous status and her own wealth and education. In her mind, she was the superior, pulling the strings of these hapless schmucks entangled in her suggestions of sexual gratitude. And all of those things could have built for us an interesting villainess, even if clichéd, if the dialogue streaming from her mouth hadn't been so flat, hackneyed, and stupid. I might have bought into her as a seductress if the show had any real sexual tension in it, but it didn't. Another problem here is one with Nick's morality. As I mentioned, I don't buy that he's so easily seduced by Anne. He just turns on a dime with Natalie. I think it would have been more interesting if he had tried to two-time her. Have his rendezvous with Anne, and then have him try to act like nothing's going on with Natalie. Have Nick lie to her or gaslight her. Have Nick mirror Anne's manipulation onto Natalie. Only maybe Nat doesn't take Nick's shit and calls him out, thus making Nick reevaluate the way he handles relationships, make him choose between the cheap thrill offered by Anne and something more honest and substantial offered by Natalie. Then it's Natalie that pulls Nick away from the darkness. She becomes his moral compass. As it stands in the episode, Nick just sort of vacillates with not much rhyme or reason. What is great about man, Nietzsche writes, is that he is a bridge and not a goal. Life, for Nietzsche, is that which must always overcome itself. And so, we see Nick struggling to overcome his own dark urges and impulses, tied to the still mysterious motivations for his vampiric origins. He strives to find out what kind of man he is, what kind of creature he can become, to struggle against these instincts, to find peace in a life he makes for himself in mimicry of the living, of the human. At the end of the episode, I just don't feel like Nick has made any progress or learned anything about himself or his condition. He's pissed off his girlfriend, and that's about it. So there it is, guys. I wish I had more to examine, but this episode just wasn't giving me much to work with. Certainly, I didn't do any of Nietzsche's thoughts justice in this episode, so it's something I'll have to come back to at a later one. Next week, we'll watch the episode entitled Dying to Know You, Season 1, Episode 6, which has to do with psychics, apparently, so that'll be fun. Until then, gentle listener, thank you for your kind attention as we all wander through our own personal forever night. And now a quick word from our sponsor. Still Dreaming is a podcast hosted and recorded by me in the newly revamped CERK Internet Radio Studio. Forever Night was produced for CBS by Glenn Warren Productions and Sony Pictures Television. All rights reserved.